Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Next Tuesday is the deadline for U.S. troops to pull out of most Iraqi cities and move back to their bases. And as they leave, deadly suicide bombings killed over 160 people, rather, in Iraq over the last 5 days. And newly released documents reveal what Saddam Hussein told his FBI interrogator after he was captured in 2003. The Obama administration has released more than 100 pages of newly declassified papers. James Gordon Meek, national security correspondent for the Daily News, has been reading them and broke the story of the documents today. James, some of what you write about feels familiar. Saddam's FBI interrogator, George Pirro, has been interviewed. But what's it like to actually read these papers?
It's an absolutely enthralling read, Robin, because if nothing else, you see how the FBI conducted probably, arguably, the most successful high-profile interrogation in the history. It's 100-year history. And you see how Special Agent George Pirro, who was a Lebanese-American immigrant to this country and a rising star in the Bureau, got the truth out of Saddam Hussein on pretty much every subject you could think of relevant to Iraq, from his rise to power to the Iran-Iraq War, to the both Gulf Wars, the rise of the insurgency, how Saddam evaded capture for so many months after the U.S. Toppled him from power. It's just a fascinating look at the mind of Saddam Hussein, but also how the FBI was able to get him to tell the truth about committing crimes against humanity.
Well, let's start there. Did the FBI use torture?
Absolutely not. No, they used this old-fashioned technique that you and I are using called having a conversation. It's they call it officially rapport-based interrogations. But it literally is two guys sitting across from each other in a room with some nice carpets and paintings on the wall and a Cuban cigar and having a chat and doing this for, you know, every day or every other day for months.
And also included, apparently, George Pirro once gave Saddam cookies his Lebanese mother had made. And Saddam thought that this was a very important interrogation. He viewed himself as writing history?
Yes. Saddam maintained for months that he was still the president of Iraq. He got angry once when Pirro said he was the ex-president of Iraq. But by the time the interrogations were winding up, Saddam was resigned to the fact that he was no longer the president of Iraq, he was no longer in control, and that he was going to soon die. And Pirro told him as much in the end. And he accepted that, and he wanted, yes, he wanted his place in history to be written. He said that his history, his role, his value would be assessed in 500 to 1,000 years from now.
Well, let's tick through some of the things that he told George Pirro. What did he say about weapons of mass destruction?
Some of the stuff we know from reporting, from investigations by Congress and the intelligence community and others, the CIA, he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. He basically described a shell game where he, to some degree, miscalculated, a great degree miscalculated, how the U.S. was not only going to respond to the 9/11 attacks, but also his defiance, which was all geared towards what he viewed as the real threat. He didn't fear a U.S. attack, he said. He said he had sustained those before. What he feared was the growing arsenal of his neighbor, Iran, that he referred to the Ayatollahs as fanatics, that while he was being disarmed by the United Nations, they were building their arsenal.
Well, in fact, he even says at one point he would have turned to George Bush for help if Iran had attacked him.
George W. Bush, that's right.
Yeah.
If he had been fully disarmed and the UN had lifted the sanctions against Iraq, he felt he would have had no choice but to turn to the United States for a security agreement to protect him from his neighbors, mainly Iran,
which
is extraordinary.
And he goes on to say that he would never have joined any forces with Osama bin Laden because he feared him. In fact, he would more likely have turned to North Korea.
Exactly. He confirmed a number of high-level meetings that his top spies had with al-Qaeda people, but he also made it clear that they thought al-Qaeda, that bin Laden was a zealot, he called him, and that they couldn't be trusted. They had asked for, an emissary was sent to ask for $10 million, which he turned down, because he thought al-Qaeda would turn against him at some point.
Well, there are smaller details as well. You mentioned that we learn how Saddam Hussein avoided being picked up by U.S. forces. How did he do that?
Well, he gradually dismissed his bodyguards one by one, he said, and he was in Baghdad until the night Baghdad fell. His last words to his aides, his henchmen, were, "We will struggle in secret," which set up, in effect, he claimed, the insurgency. But he also denied ever using body doubles. He said that was just movie magic and not reality, and of course he never had body doubles.
Well, James Gordon Meek, it sounds as if you're saying that the biggest takeaway from these papers is that Saddam Hussein was thinking of aligning himself with George W. Bush against Iran before the U.S. invaded him. Huge irony there. But as we read these papers now, as U.S. troops begin to pull out of the cities, what other overarching thought do you take away?
I think Saddam thought that his people were going to rise up to take up his flag and were going to take Iraq back for him. I know from my own reporting that that was, and you see some of this in the documents, that that was his belief. But it actually turned out otherwise. They took up their own interests, and now the political interests are beginning to really overcome the al-Qaeda in Iraq's dream of establishing an Islamic extremist caliphate, as they call it, it's beginning in Iraq.
Now, you think that's true? So, because, of course, we're seeing this week huge bombings in Iraq.
Yeah, I think arguably that's the death throes of al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's a very, even the Iraqi version of this organization that was, ostensibly led by aides to Osama bin Laden over the years, or allies. That's a very diminished organization. There's not much left of them. They are, al-Qaeda's focusing its efforts elsewhere. So I think what you're seeing here is, the last throes of this organization. I think the commanders in Iraq have been clear there are going to be tough days ahead. I think there will be. But it is hard to see al-Qaeda in Iraq at this point, taking up the mantle and the movement to the extent they did a couple of years ago, and really causing widespread havoc.
James Gordon Meek, national security correspondent for the New York Daily News, will link you to his writing, and also as he begins to post these newly released documents about interrogations of Saddam Hussein, we'll link you to those postings as well at hereandnow.org. Jim, thanks so much, as always, for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's turn now to Iraq's neighbor, Iran, where opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi said today he has not given up. In his first words since Sunday, Mousavi defiantly said, "I am not ready to withdraw from demanding the rights of the Iranian people," adding he was determined to prove electoral fraud. Yesterday, 70 university professors were detained after meeting with Mousavi, and a march by another opposition leader planned for today was postponed after authorities refused to issue permits for it. Well, today, we want to take a look at the clerical hierarchy behind the crackdown on the opposition. Mehdi Khalji is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute, a journalist, and a trained Shiite theologian. Mehdi, thanks so much for our primer today on Iran's Shia clergy.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to start with the very basics. And by the way, listeners can go to hereandnow.org, where we'll have names and pictures if you want to follow along. The current supreme leader is Ayatollah Khamenei, and that's Khamenei. We know the supreme leader is considered by many Iranians to be God's representative on earth, but Khamenei has critics, and we're going to explain why. But just how significant is it to see Iranians in the past 2 weeks shouting death to the supreme leader?
I think it is very important because it didn't happen before, at least in this large scale. The demonstrators basically started their protest against the election result. But since Ayatollah Khamenei spoke on the Friday prayer and he condemned the demonstrations and he said that the responsibility of any casualty and violence would be on the organizers of these demonstrations, that provoked people and actually radicalized the movement. So this is Ayatollah Khamenei who pushed people toward taking a more radical position and actually extending their demands from just the election issue to the system as a whole.
Well, and that's what we're going to take a look at. So take us back. Khamenei succeeded Ayatollah Khomeini, who overthrew the Western-backed Shah of Iran in 1979 and began the Islamic Revolution. He had been exiled years before his successful revolution. So first of all, why was he exiled? And what was the Ayatollah's role back then?
Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Republic, was the most outspoken critic of Shah's regime and his different policies, from his economic policies to his culture and political and foreign policies. So Shah expelled him first to Turkey and then from Turkey to Iraq, to Najaf, where he lived for about 14 years. And in the last month before revolution, he went to Paris, where he was able to deliver his message to the world. And actually, his stay in Paris was very important because he had access to the free media and he was talking every day with international news agencies and journalists. So he was a charismatic leader. He was a revolutionary leader. Nobody appointed him to this position. And that's a big difference between Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Republic, and Ayatollah Khamenei, the current supreme leader, who was appointed to this position. And actually what happened 20 years ago when Khamenei came to power was that even the legal procedures were not respected. Actually, the appointment of Khamenei was not completely legal.
And that brings us to the former president, Ali Rafsanjani. He's also a cleric, but he's one who helped bring the current supreme leader to power. So tell us more about that and the thinking of Iranians today, that there was something not quite right with how the current supreme leader came to power.
Yeah. The supreme leader, as I said, lacked three important things. One was the charisma of Ayatollah Khomeini. Second was political credential. And third was religious credential. You know that when we call somebody Ayatollah, it means that he has religious right and authority to issue fatwa or decree on different religious issues. So Khamenei was not an Ayatollah and was not recognized as an Ayatollah in the clerical establishment and circles. But at the same day that he was appointed as the supreme leader, the state media started to call him an Ayatollah. So he became an Ayatollah not through the religious procedure, but through a political means and political media.
Mehdi Khalighi, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute. We're going to take a break. When we come back, so Iran's current supreme leader may be disliked by many because of the way he achieved power, but he seems to be holding on to that power. Will that last? We'll be back in a minute with that. Coming up later in the program, is texting affecting the way teens develop? One researcher says yes. Back after the break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Mehdi Khalighi, a journalist who was trained as a Shiite theologian in Iran before he went on to study in the West. And Mehdi, you were telling us that in 1979, the Ayatollah was able to rally the country's clerics to overthrow the Shah of Iran, many of those clerics living in one of the spiritual centers of Iran, in Qom, where you were born. But what's happening today? Do the clerics that are in Iran today speak in one voice?
No. Actually, we don't have in Islam in general the clerical establishment as we do in, for example, Catholicism. There is no Vatican in Islam and there is no central authority like Pope. For example, if you are a Shia and you want to exercise or practice your religion, you have to follow some religious jurist. But you are not forced to follow anyone. It is your choice.
But we understood that after the revolution, the new constitution included a clerical check on power in the form of the Council of Guardians. And we've understood that it's the Council of Guardians that's actually you know, ruling the country far more than the president, which also made many in the West believe that they also ruled all the clerics.
They want to, but they cannot. The fact is, Ayatollah Khamenei, the current supreme leader, when he came to power 20 years ago, he created actually a council of management of the Iranian seminaries.
Well, in fact, you say that in the last 30 years, there's been a real shift in the clerical establishment in Iran that many Western eyes may not have seen. Is this what you're speaking of, what the current supreme leader has done to sort of institute some of these groups to try to control clerics?
Yes. The system was based on oral culture, not written culture. When Khamenei came to power, he had problem with clerics. So in order to solve this problem, he felt that he has to change fundamentally this system. For example, before revolution, if a cleric wanted to receive his salary, he just was going to an office of an Ayatollah, and because they knew all clerics, they were paying him his salary monthly. But after Khamenei came to power, he computerized everything. Huh. So he created a very important information center, a branch of the Ministry of Intelligence, powerful enough to control every record of clerics.
So what he's done, the current supreme leader, is not only politicize the clergy, but as you say, in computerizing it, create a bureaucracy.
Exactly.
And this leads us back to the former president Rafsanjani, who, as we said, helped put the current supreme leader in power, even though he didn't have the religious depth that the previous one did. And now Rafsanjani is backing the opposition, and he also heads some powerful bodies that oversee the supreme leader. Do you think, as some are speculating, that Rafsanjani is now trying to engineer the current supreme leader out of office or even change the setup completely so that there isn't one supreme leader anymore in Iran?
Yes. What we have seen in terms of election was a coup d'etat of Khamenei and military and revolutionary guard against the old generation of revolution who are known as reformists. Rafsanjani and Khatami and other people, Khamenei was not able to eliminate them. So a couple of weeks ago, Khamenei felt that he is self-confident enough to get rid of them through a manipulated election. If he fails to manage this crisis, I think that his position would be weakened soon and Rafsanjani and other people come up with another solution. And you know that Rafsanjani, since 2 years ago, he started to speak about the failure of the notion of the ruling jurist. He said that we cannot give too much power to one person in the name of the ruling jurist.
Ruling jurist, meaning the supreme leader?
Yes.
Yes.
And he started to say that we need to create a council of leadership rather than a supreme leader. So this statement showed that he's not happy with what Khamenei does.
And we're well aware Rafsanjani has his critics. He's a billionaire considered corrupt, was a hardliner, as we said, but as you're saying, may succeed in changing the hierarchy of clerics. Meantime, what about the clerics across the country? How significant is it that we have seen some clerics in their turbans at the opposition rallies? We know they're not all speaking in one voice, but how are the clerics across the board responding to what's going on in the streets?
Many of clerics in Iran, especially Grand Ayatollahs, they voted Amir Hossein Mousavi. They are not happy with Ahmadinejad. Especially this time, I haven't seen any Grand Ayatollah supporting Ahmadinejad, because Ahmadinejad is not only have a very damaging economic policies, but also he has some religious claims which are not pleasant for the clerics. For example, his claim that I have relationship with the hidden imam, the Shiite Messiah. Ahmadinejad wants to compete with clerics religiously. So he's not a popular man among clerics. But the question is, the oppression machinery of the government in Iran is powerful so much that clerics, they don't dare to put their life and position at risk. But we hear some voices say that what the government does in terms of using force against the peaceful demonstrators, it is haram or illegal in Islam. And government, by using force against people, is losing its legitimacy.
Mehdi Khalaji, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute, a journalist who is also trained as a Shiite theologian. Mehdi, thank you so much for helping us better understand the clergy in Iran. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And taking just a second to say we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story on the program, just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can leave a comment right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. We'll be back after the latest news. There's a new discovery about Saturn's moons. Here and Now. A frantic man calls the front desk of a motel and says, "Quick, set off a fire sprinkler, sound an alarm, or break windows. There's a fire." He urges the person on the other end of the phone to act quickly. Many times recently they have, only to find out later it's a prank. Prank calls have resulted in thousands of dollars in damages to hotels and motels in California, Nebraska, Arkansas, and Alabama. Four of the targets are in Alabama. They include hotels in Gadsden, Birmingham, Daphne, and Saraland. Alabama State Fire Marshal Ed Polk joins us now. Ed, we know you're investigating. Do you have any idea who's made these prank calls?
Well, we know that it's young people, and we know that they're prank calls, and we're working with our court systems and with the phone companies, along with the victims of the crime, in an effort to trace the calls, find out where they're coming from, in an effort to identify the parties involved.
You say crime. What kind of crime is this?
Well, there's two actual crimes taking place. One of them is criminal mischief, when the callers convince someone to activate the fire sprinkler system, which discharges water. The water then causes damage to the property. And the second crime would be that of a false fire alarm. Rendering a false fire alarm is a crime. It's a misdemeanor crime unless the facility has handicapped people housed in the facility. Then it would be a felony crime, actually.
Well, and in which case, what are we looking at here if you find this person? How would it be punishable?
Well, we've had some with several $1,000 worth of damage. Criminal mischief in excess of $2,000 is also a felony crime, which is punishable by 1 to 10 years in prison or fines up to $10,000.
So what are some of the things that the caller's getting people to do?
They're causing them to break windows out, causing them to set the fire sprinkler systems off, and causing them to set the fire alarm systems off.
Well, we understand in Nebraska, a man was even convinced to drive his truck through the door of a hotel lobby, supposedly to set off a fire alarm. In California, a worker activated a sprinkler at the front desk that ruined computers, phones, other electrical equipment. You know, I'm thinking, too, that another side effect of this is if someone really is calling about a fire, someone may not pay attention to them because of these pranks.
Exactly.
What are you telling people who own what seem to be the targets, motels and hotels and people who work there? What are you telling them to do?
Well, first thing is we're telling them is these systems are automatic systems. They're designed to respond to conditions on the property. The fire alarm system will activate in the presence of a fire. The fire sprinkler system will activate in the presence of a fire, and they'll do their jobs. The fire alarm system will sound a general alarm, and in a lot of cases where it's required, it makes places a call to the fire department. The fire sprinkler system, when it activates the result of a fire, it places water on the fire itself. And it does so very selectively because only the heads affected by the fire, or only the heads that are affected by the fire, are the ones that discharge water.
So, in other words, people should still pull fire alarms to alert the fire department that there is a fire. But if there is a fire, people should never be asked to activate a sprinkler system.
Exactly. If you get a call from anyone claiming to be with the fire department, telling you to do something for them, if it's an emergency and they need to have something done, they will come to you. You don't have to get a call from them.
You had four of these cases. Has it stopped? Are you afraid it's still going to go on?
Well, there's always the potential for it to continue. Copycats and all sorts of things. It's out all over the internet. It's people making bad choices in the name of fun. And that's how so many crimes occur. So sooner or later, we'll catch one of them, and they've had a bad day.
That's Alabama State Fire Marshal Ed Polk. Ed, thanks so much for speaking to us about this.
You're quite welcome.
And this quick note, today marks 100 days since the arrest of current TV journalists Yuna Lee and Laura Ling by North Korean officials. The women are accused of entering North Korea illegally, and they face 12 years hard labor. Lee's husband said the women were allowed to call home this weekend. He said both women are sick and afraid of being sent to a labor camp.
I tried to comfort her, and nothing I could say could. I wanted to hold her, and I couldn't. I just felt helpless.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have more on the fledgling network Current TV and how they're covering this story. That's tomorrow. Back in half a minute, Here and Now. Do you send text messages? It's the quickest way to get a message out of, say, a meeting. No one can notice your thumbs flying as you type out a note, although some managers are clamping down on that. And according to the Nielsen Company, American teenagers sent or received an average of 2,272 text messages a month in the fourth quarter of last year. That's almost 80 a day, more than double the average from the year before. Should anyone be worried about that? Sherry Turkle is. She's professor of social studies and technology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She also directs the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self, and her new book is Simulation and Its Discontents. As part of her research, she's been interviewing young people here in the Boston area about texting. Professor, we read in the New York Times about a girl texting 15,000 times a month. In your research, you found teens texting 8,000 times a month. What are your thoughts?
I'm concerned that when you have something that will expand to fill the space, these teens never get a moment when they're quiet. They never get a moment to rest. Essentially, you're dealing with an always-on technology where when you ask kids, well, are you texting all the time? They kind of look at you a little blankly because from their point of view, it's just always there and they do it while they're doing other things. They'll answer you with things like, oh, but it's only two words. And they're right. It's only two words. The issue is, what happens to a life, what happens to concentration, and what happens to the developmental issues that teens need to deal with when they're texting all the time.
And what do you think happens?
Well, just to take one of the jobs of adolescence, it's a time when teens are supposed to sort of define their boundaries and to have a certain autonomy. If you're constantly looking for validation from other people, you know, getting that message out, needing an immediate response, teens move from, I have a feeling and I want to send a text, to, I want to have a feeling, I need to send a text.
Yeah.
In other words, the validation comes so much from other people that it's almost like you lose the sense of feeling your own feelings. Or another job of adolescence is intimacy. Intimacy requires that you really become kind of an expert in the face-to-face. And teens use texting as a way to avoid the risks of the face-to-face, the risks of being turned down. And if you do that, you see that when you interview them, they sort of don't know the difference between an apology and a confession. Their idea of apologizing is to send a confession in a text, but an apology is really different. An apology, you face someone, you see you've hurt them, you feel bad, and you try to make it right in the kind of delicate negotiation of a conversation. And if you're texting all the time and you're not learning how to do that kind of thing, or, you know, identity, the main job of adolescence. Eric Erickson wrote that teens need stillness in order to develop identity, stillness for self-reflection. There's no stillness if you're vibrating 80 times a day.
And I'm wondering if there's another issue here. You say stillness. I'm thinking sleep. I mean, this girl, for instance, that was doing over 15,000 texts a month would keep the phone on after going to bed. She would switch it to vibrate. She'd wait for it to light up. She wasn't sleeping.
Yeah, the teens I'm interviewing have a lot of trouble with sleep. And parents can do something here. Just like Barack Obama has a basket outside of his office and the cell phones and the BlackBerries and the iPhones go in there, you can say no text in the bedroom.
Some people have also questioned, attention spans. Last year, The Atlantic published an article entitled, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And the case was made that we don't have to remember anything because we just Google things. And so because we don't have to remember things, we're not exercising our brain. And there's been a lot written about multitasking that kids engage in. It's shortening their attention spans. Are you worried about that?
Well, it's interesting. Multitasking is a grown-up word. Teenagers that I'm talking to don't experience their life like multitasking. For them, life isn't like Swiss cheese where you take time out from the real cheese to have a hole. They see their life like a mesh where the hole is the mesh. There aren't holes in the mesh. The mesh is the hole. And so you really are seeing people developing a new sensibility where they're more comfortable with the world of always on you communication, but that doesn't mean it's good for them. They can be comfortable, and yet you also see a kind of anxiety of connection and an anxiety of disconnection. And in some ways, their parents aren't helping them. I have lots of teenagers who say, look, you know, I do text, but I come down to breakfast in the morning, and the parent is doing their email. My daughter's called me out on my email. She'll say, are we having breakfast or not? I have an 18-year-old daughter. And a lot of teenagers complain about coming out of their sports event, coming out of their after-school program, and finding the parent in the car texting or on the cell phone.
Ah.
And, you know, teenagers, even if they're texting 8,000 times a month, teenagers want the undivided attention of their parents.
So they're thinking that parents are being a little hypocritical.
Absolutely.
Do you worry about their thumbs? Or is that just silly?
Oh, I absolutely worry about their thumbs.
You do.
I talk to pediatricians all the time who tell me that their thumbs are in danger. Pediatricians are seeing the kind of repetitive stress injuries with thumbs that generations of orthopedists are seeing with the carpal tunnels of their
really?
Parents.
Really? Because we were joking about this and saying, you know, when you say that you're doing a segment on the dangers of texting, it sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit. You know, let's have a fundraiser for kids who text. How bad could it be? But you're saying that there are, you've already said developmental, but also potential physical problems.
Absolutely.
So what are parents to do? Just take it away? Can they go cold turkey?
You know, I think you have to let each generation live with the technology of its time, because if they don't live with it, they won't really learn the skills of how to manage it into a fuller life. But I think that the idea that you don't text at dinner, you don't text in your bedroom, you don't text during class, when you talk to adults about how they handle it, they throw up their hands and say, that's just the way it is. I think that these are very early days for us. But this doesn't have to be the way it is.
Well, and you say early days. This is the first generation that is texting at this level.
Yeah, but I believe that for every technology, it takes some time for us to decide, is it serving our human purposes the way we're using it? And I think that for teens and texting, as more and more of the story comes in about the developmental issues that teens are simply not able to do as well if texting is constant, you're going to get some pushback. Even some teenagers will tell you, you know, I wonder if I'm going to be doing this when I have a job.
You know, you speak to teens. As much as they might say that they love doing it, and it's only a couple of words, and they've said that to you, have you felt from any teenagers that, please take this away from me, I feel trapped by it?
I would say yes. I talk to a lot of teens who feel that there is no choice because if they don't have it, people will think there's something wrong with them. People will think that they don't want to get back to their friends. And I think that social mores are going to start to move in a direction where you see some pushback, both from grown-ups and from teenagers.
Sherry Turkle, director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self, also professor of social studies and technology at MIT. Her new book, Simulation and Its Discontents. Can you just give us one line?
Well, we're living our lives on the screen. We're building our buildings on the screen. We're designing our environments on the screen. And sometimes it really is better to use a pencil.
We'll have to have you back to talk about that. Sherry Turkle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just a quick reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, where you can also download a podcast. Take us with us when you go, hereandnow.org. Up next, our summer book picks for older tweens, themes ranging from summer camp to the Vietnam War. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back to Here Now with a quick news note from outer space. A discovery astronomers believe may suggest life could evolve on one of Saturn's moons. The journal Nature reports today NASA's unmanned spacecraft Cassini discovered salt in particles it collected from jets of vapor and ice erupting from Saturn's moon Enceladus. Kelly Beatty of Sky and Telescope magazine says that could be a sign of an ocean underneath the icy surface.
There's probably a deep cavern where the water is slowly evaporating, just like water evaporates from an ocean. And that's good news for the prospects for life, because there's water, there's a salty environment that gives it the sort of chemical mix it needs, and there's an energy source, because something has to melt this water that far out. The bottom line here is that we're beginning to see the conditions that would be conducive for life, but we're a long way from seeing anything that would suggest there's actually life there.
Kelly Beatty of Sky and Telescope magazine. As we all suddenly become more interested in Saturn's 60, that's 60 moons. Most schools are out for summer vacation, and we have some great book selections today for tweens to curl up with. Now, these are kids between 9 and 12 years old, somewhere between Stuart Little and Great Expectations. Yesterday, we talked about books for younger tweens, 9 and up. Today, 11 and 12-year-olds. All these titles are going to be at our website. As we welcome Sherry Eskin, children's librarian at the Honan Alston branch of the Boston Public Library. Sherry, let's start with the book 11 by Laura Miracle. The main character is a girl named Winnie, who's struggling to deal with the changes that come with adolescence. Before we talk about the book, here's a reading from Naomi Foreman Katz of Franklin Elementary in West Newton, Massachusetts.
Everyone says change is what makes life an adventure, that when you change, you grow, and if you don't change, you'll shrivel up and rot like an old potato. Well, baloney. The people who get rah-rah over change are always parents and librarians, not kids. Because when kids change, it's really pretty ugly. 3 times out of 4, it means someone's going to get her feelings hurt, or someone's going to feel stupid when the day before she felt just fine.
Oh, I've never heard a more perfect description of being 11, 12.
Being 11, it can be pretty horrible. And this book just captures it so well. She's just right on the cusp. And one of her friends is wearing the bikini to the beach and kind of winking at the guys. And she's there in her baggy old one piece from last year. And she's just not quite there yet. She's only just on the cusp. But she wants it. You know, she wants to sit at the couple's table on Valentine's Day. She wants it, but she's getting there.
Again, that's 11 by Lauren Miracle. Here's where boys and girls in their tweens are splitting off and reading
absolutely.
Different books.
Girls are definitely reading the issue books. And that's true in teen books as well. Girls are definitely interested in themselves, in their changing, in their feelings. Boys are not interested necessarily their feelings.
We want to be clear that, of course, there's some boys and some girls who are going to be out of the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Boys are still interested in adventure. They're interested in humor, adventure, and silly humor.
Potty humor, right?
Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to kids nearly teenagers, 12 years old. First, we have Three Willows, The Sisterhood Grows. This is by the author of The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants books, Anne Brashears. It takes place in the summer after eighth grade, revolves around three friends. Can you just tell us a little bit about the friends?
Yeah. One friend is a brilliant academic girl and wants to go to the kind of camp that's like school all summer long. And instead, she ends up in a wilderness camp. She has a really hard time with that. She hasn't spent much time outdoors, but she really does find something good in the experience. It takes her a while, though. Another girl works at a resort restaurant with all high school girls. She's the only bus girl, works with all high school girls, and gets a little in over her head with a boy. The boy is attracted to her. She's attracted to him, but it's definitely too much for her. He's a few years older than she is. The last girl wants to be a model and has a kind of unhealthy obsession with it that leads to some sort of bad feelings about her body and just a sort of brush with anorexia. And it's, you know, I mean, you think of anorexia as being a teen problem, and it's really not. This girl isn't even in high school yet and is already having poor body image.
Okay. So here's Olivia Mazzapizza reading a passage about the first friend you mentioned. This is Amma, who just found out she got a scholarship to a prestigious summer camp program. It's a wilderness one, not the one she wants.
I don't really like the outdoors. I'm not outdoorsy. I'm more indoorsy. Mrs. Sherman sighed for about the 45th time. Amma, maybe you can keep an open mind about this. Amma couldn't keep an open mind. She didn't have an open mind. She didn't even want an open mind. She wanted Andover. She wanted books and libraries and classes where she could get good grades. She wanted A pluses and gold stars and extra credit.
By the way, these readings are great.
They're fabulous.
And so again, that's Three Willows, The Sisterhood Grows, maybe a book that might be more appealing to 12-year-old girls. One that features boys is The Wednesday Wars by Gary Schmidt. The main character, Holling Hood-Hood. Benny Ruver is going to read for us a passage where Holling Hood-Hood first realizes he's going to have to spend Wednesdays with Mrs. Baker, who, as you'll hear, is not happy with his grammar.
"Hood-Hood," she said quietly. She thought for a moment. "Does your family attend Temple Beth-El?" she said. I shook my head. "St. Adalbert's, then?" she asked this kind of hopefully. I shook my head again. "So on Wednesday afternoon you attend neither Hebrew school nor catechism?" I nodded. "You are here with me." "I guess," I said. Mrs. Baker looked hard at me. I think she rolled her eyes. Since the mutilation of "guess" into an intransitive verb is a crime against the language, perhaps you might wish a full sentence to avoid prosecution. Something as, "I guess that Wednesday afternoons will be busy after all." That's when I knew she hated me.
Well, I'm pulled into this, so I guess we see what happens on Wednesday afternoons between Holly Hood-Hood and Mrs. Baker.
Well, they read a lot of Shakespeare, but they also learn a lot about each other. It takes place in 67 in Long Island during the Vietnam War. Mrs. Baker's husband is fighting in the Vietnam War. There's a lot of issues going on. Holling Hood-Hood, his dad's an architect. He's expected to sort of carry on the family name. There's lots of family pressure. But there's also some hilarious scenes. There's a great scene involving the classroom rats and a bunch of cream puffs. It's excellent.
Okay. Well, though, taking 12-year-olds back to the Vietnam era, they're going. Is this a popular book?
Yeah, it is a popular book. I think it's great because it's humor, but it's a little subtle. It's not as in your face as a lot of books. But the man who wrote this also he's an award-winning writer. He's very well respected, and kids do read this book and love it.
Gary Schmidt. Well, and that's Sherry Eskin, children's librarian at the Hone and Alston branch of the Boston Public Library, our Marion, the librarian. She had some great tween titles for the summer. By the way, we also want to thank the fifth graders at Franklin Elementary School in West Newton, Massachusetts, with their really quite wonderful readings. For more thoughts from the students about some of the books, and again, for the list, go to our website, hereandnow.org. But whatever you do this summer, read. Right, Sherry?
Absolutely.
It's the best staycation there is.
Yes, it is.
What can I do, my dear, to catch your ear? I love you madly, madly, Madam Librarian, Marion. Heaven help us if the library caught on fire and the volunteer hose brigade men had to whisper the news to Marion. Madam Librarian, what can I do, my dear, to make it clear? I need you badly, badly, Madam Librarian, Marion. If I stumble and I busted my whatchamacallit, I could lie on your floor unnoticed till my body had turned to carrion. Madam Librarian. Now in the moonlight, a man could sing it. In the moonlight, and a fellow would know that his darling had heard every word of his song with the moonlight helping along. But when I try in here to tell you, dear, I love you madly, madly, Madam Librarian, Marion, it's a long lost cause I can never win. For the civilized world accepts as unforgivable sin any talking out loud with any librarian, such as Madam Librarian.